Ellery Shemp didn't know he was firing an opening shot in the culture wars, but he knew what he was doing on that November day in 1956. It was time for Ellery's high school class to read 10 verses from the Bible. Ellery refused. Instead, he read silently from the Quran. That sparked a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. In 1963, the court outlawed school-sponsored prayer. The case is the subject of a new book, Ellery's Protest. Author Stephen Solomon is in our New York Bureau. Welcome to the program, Mr. Solomon.
Thank you very much.
And Ellery Shemp is in member station WBUR in Boston. Mr. Shemp, welcome to the program to you as well.
It's nice to be with you.
Mr. Solomon, let me start with you. How common was prayer in the public schools in 1956?
In Pennsylvania, it was universal because there was a state law that required 10 verses of the Bible to be read. In the United States, about 40% of the school districts had Bible reading.
Mr. Shemp, why did you do what you did?
Well, I was concerned that this was an infringement of the First Amendment's clause that says that there shall be no establishment of religion, and it seemed to me that this was a very obvious violation of favored principle of separation of church and state. Of course, the Bible was also a symbol of authority, the way it was used in the schools, and I guess there was a healthy dose of teenage rebellion.
You were 16 years old.
Yes.
If your protest was against the separation of church and state, essentially, no prayers in the public schools, why did you use the Quran? What was the significance of that?
Oh, I merely wanted to show that there were other holy books besides the Bible. The Quran was purely by accident because one was available. Otherwise, it would have been a Hindu holy scripture.
How fast was your heart beating when you were reading that?
Obviously, I was nervous, and I can't remember a word from what I might have scanned in the Quran. And I did not stand for the Lord's Prayer, and that's what, I guess, made my statement more obvious.
Well, what happened to you after your act of disobedience?
Well, the teacher initially, of course, was enormously puzzled, but I said that I had thought about this and that as a matter of religious conscience, I couldn't participate any longer. He sent me to the school disciplinarian. And after some discussion, he sent me to the school guidance counselor. They were very curious as to whether or not they had a disturbed young man on their hands.
Well, that was the beginning of a very long journey of right up into the Supreme Court. And Stephen Solomon, we actually have excerpts from the arguments before the Supreme Court. Philip Ward represented the school district in the state of Pennsylvania, and he argued that the reading of 10 verses from the Bible is acceptable because it is teaching morality, not religion. And this is a tape of Chief Justice Earl Warren challenging the attorney.
Suppose the state next says, there shall be 1 hour of instruction in morals. And during that hour of instruction, nothing shall be done except to read the Bible to the students, and all must attend except those whose parents object to it. Do you think that would be acceptable also?
I think, as the case before us now, 10 verses is acceptable. I think I agree with you, Chief Justice. It could become so bad that reasonable men couldn't say they are teaching morality. They would have to say they are doing nothing but using the Bible to indoctrinate those children with religion.
Stephen Solomon, talk about the point that Chief Justice Warren was making there.
Chief Justice Warren was really concerned about how you draw any limits around the devotional activities that were going on. If you had a 5-minute devotional activity at the beginning of the school day, how would you keep that from becoming a half-hour activity or a 1-hour activity? If you had prayer and Bible reading, could you expand that, for example, to include other devotional activities that made it more like a religious service? These were very troubling questions, and if the justices were going to allow prayer and Bible reading, they had to find some way to draw limits around it, if possible.
We also have some tape of the arguments that Henry Sawyer presented. Henry Sawyer represented the Shemps, and he argued that state-sponsored prayer is unconstitutional. And then Justice Potter Stewart challenged Sawyer. Justice Stewart said, imagine that the students themselves vote overwhelmingly to begin their day by having one of them read 10 verses from the Bible.
Isn't it a gross interference with the free exercise of the religion of those, in my imaginary case, those 98% of the student body who say our religious beliefs tell us that this is what we want to do?
Well, they have a right to do it, Your Honor, but they haven't got a right to get the state to help them.
Stephen Solomon that sentence. They haven't got the right to get the state to help them. The justice was arguing that the First Amendment protects the free exercise of religion, including school prayer. Why did his argument then find so little traction?
His argument found little traction because the exercises in school, the Bible reading and the prayer, were clearly religious activities. They were devotional activities, the kinds of things that you do in church or synagogue. And the state was, in fact, by law, requiring that these exercises be taken place. And the state, therefore, was endorsing or supporting religion in a way that violated the First Amendment.
The justice voted 8-1 to order the end of Bible reading and recitation of the Lord's Prayer in public schools. What were the deliberations like?
This was not a difficult case for the justices to decide. There were five liberal justices on the court at that time. All five of them voted to remove prayer and Bible reading from the schools. And of the four conservatives, three, including Justice John Marshall Harlan, who was the conservative intellectual leader of the court, three of the four conservatives also agreed with the majority to remove the devotional activities. The issue became a lot more complicated later, even though it was an 8-1 decision, especially in the last 15 or 20 years with the rise of the religious right. You've had a lot of political agitation for prayer, for the teaching of intelligent design, for the teaching of creationism, the use of Bibles in the classroom, the posting of the Ten Commandments. So in many ways, the argument has become more complicated and much more expanded.
Mm. Ellery Shemp, what were the repercussions immediately in your hometown, in your neighborhood, in your school?
Well, we had a fairly decent little community in Abington, and there was not very much really nasty stuff. My brother and sister were roughed up a little bit, and my sister she was only 11 or 12 at the time and felt very embarrassed to be singled out this way. Our family got about 5,000 letters, and about one-third were supportive, and even from a fairly large number of Christians, actually, who took the Bible's injunction in Matthew 6, they took that quite seriously about praying in private. About one-third were disagreements, but reasonable ones, and then, of course, the remaining one-third were hateful and vituperative.
Hmm. You teach First Amendment law at New York University now, Mr. Solomon?
Yes, in the Department of Journalism.
So what's the class discussion like when you teach your students the case of Ellery Shemp?
You know, these are students, so they're in their, 18 maybe to 25, and so they look at this case in ways that are sometimes surprising to adults who are arguing about this today. One of the things that the students talk about is what if the prayer and Bible reading came back to the schools? What prayers would you actually use? Whose prayers? What version of the Bible? The Protestant Bible or the Catholic Bible? The Jewish Bible would use the Quran? And then the discussion goes to the idea that what kind of conflict would this cause in local communities? And would school board elections be fraught with religious overtones rather than just arguments over curriculum and other kinds of educational activities? So students are very concerned about that because they've just come out of high schools and they understand that these are very serious issues that would affect them.
Mm. Ellery Shemp, how important a part has this case been in your life during the past 50 years?
Well, it's the lawyers who did all the work in arguing the case, and for me, I was pursuing a career in science. I studied physics and was a physics professor, and then I worked in industry and did what was called at that time solid-state physics. I wound up working with General Electric for several years on MRI systems, and there were many, many years in which I hardly thought about it, except when other cases somewhat related to it came before the court. But in the last 5 or 7 years, and after I've sort of retired from my science career, I've spent a lot more time talking about it. I'm being asked to talk about it.
Could you have imagined on that November day when you were 16 that what you were doing then would still be resonating some 50 years later?
It's a little dismaying to find that that is the case. I would have thought that we could have moved on from there. But I do think it was a triumph of our system, of an independent judicial system, and I was very pleased that an average family could bring a case and it could be resolved.
Stephen Solomon is the author of Ellery's Protest, How One Young Man Defied Tradition and Sparked the Battle Over School Prayer. He joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Ellery Shemp refused to participate in the mandatory Bible reading exercise at his Pennsylvania high school in 1956. His case led to the Supreme Court ruling that declared school-sponsored Bible reading in public schools to be unconstitutional. Ellery Shemp joined us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Thank you for your time.
It was a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.